WA。Unlike milk, long-distance telephone calls, and library books, there is no due date, tolls, or expiration in the grand hour. Good morning. It's the 13th of April, 2022. My name is Arthur. If you like what we're doing here at 91.5 WMFO, consider donating. Go to WMFO.org and click our donations drive tab to see how you can help us keep it freeform. Well, I missed a show last week, which was opening day, the day before opening day in Major League Baseball. It's been a couple of years since I've played what I'm about to play. It's in tribute to baseball. It's the official Centennial record album. I still don't have a date for when this was released because I thought it was 1881 was when the Cincinnati Red Stockings started up. Anyway, it's narrated by James Stewart, a friend of the show here. You'll hear him on the Six Shooter. And Kurt Gowdy. With that, we'll just go ahead and play this for baseball. Thanks.
It begins in the spring. Every spring for 100 springs. Before the last snow disappears.
Hey, Ma!
Ma, the kids are playing baseball. Where's my catcher's mitt?
Is there a home where children live? One home that doesn't echo with that sound? Or a ball field that doesn't echo with this one?
No better.
You're
no
catching. True. Nobody else wants to catch.
It's
your turn.
100 miles an hour. I'm not getting behind
it's
the
your
ball.
Turn.
No.
You're catching or you don't play.
For the professional baseball player, it begins in the spring. Every spring for 100 springs. Down south at spring training, 800 men scramble out of the clubhouse, into the dugouts, out onto the field.
I got it.
And 8 months later, 500 at-bats later, thousands of pitches later, one team, 25 men, will come off the field and into the clubhouse a winner.
Champagne over each other's heads. But if you think they're acting like a bunch of kids, that's exactly what they're doing.
A winner. What a winner baseball began with 100 years ago. The year was 1869, and the team was the Cincinnati Red Stockings. They took on all comers and piled up a record of 65 wins and no defeats. As some of the crustiest old-timers would have remarked, let's see some of the modern boys match that for percentage. And most important of all, those early red legs racked up most of those 65 wins on the road.
I was playing in Des Moines, Iowa, and you get on a train and you carry your bats in your own bag, your own uniform, roll it up and carry a uniform. You get on a train with the old wicker seats and they were burning coal. And you get in the car in July and August and go from Des Moines to Wichita, Kansas, all night, part of the next day. And if you opened up the window, you'd be eating soot and cinders all night. And if you closed the window, you'd roast to death.
They traveled 12,000 miles and showed 200,000 Americans just what this great game was all about. Americans who lived in places like St. Louis and Chicago, Hartford, Louisville, and other cities that joined together in 1876 to form the National League. Lee Allen, Hall of Fame historian, recalls those early days.
In 1876, the National League, of course, was formed, and it was discovered early that some of the cities were not large enough to support Major League Ball. So there were various shifts of franchises. Then in 1882, a rival league was formed, the American Association. It lasted 10 years and provided the National League with a great deal of rivalry. Finally, the National League absorbed four of the clubs from the American Association and became a 12-club league. Eventually, the ranks were reduced in 1900 to 8 clubs. That gave the American League a chance. And by 1901, the National and American Leagues were at war, raiding each other's rosters and engaged in a salary battle, and one league would offer more than the other did, and so on, with the result that peace was made in 1903.
In those early 1900s, while the world turned a century, baseball turned a corner. From the first stumbling footsteps of a newborn game, baseball became bold and confident and exciting. The game was exciting because the players were exciting.
Big Ed Walsh, you talk about spitballs. I think that ball disintegrated and came back together when the catcher got a hold of it.
So they're screaming out about the beanball. If I was pitching today, I'd see if I could skip him off the head.
Well, I came back to the bench. Why, he called me that SB, what are you doing out there? And he was standing on the top step, and when I hit him, he fell over on the bench.
You hit him?
I did.
You hit McGraw?
I did.
You socked him?
Uh-huh. And didn't knock him out, knocked him back into the bench.
What a tough, battling bunch they were, with colorful nicknames like the Big Train and Iron Joe and the Gray Eagle, the Flying Dutchman.
I got Cy from Cyclone. They shortened it up. And since that, I have gone by the name of Cy Young, and my name is Denton Young.
What is it that baseball has always had that Americans have always wanted? To make a game your national pastime, it's got to have a little more than just hits, runs, and errors. Now, a philosopher once wrote, "Whoever wants to know the heart and mind of America had better learn baseball. No other sport, only baseball, could have captured our hearts and our minds for the springs and the summers of 100 seasons. Our every emotion is touched by it, like laughter. Think of the times baseball has lifted our spirits with laughter."
Well, let's see, we have on the bags, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know is on third.
That's what I want to find out.
I say, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know's on third.
Are you the manager?
Yes.
You're going to be the coach, too?
Yes.
And you know the fellow's name?
Oh, I should.
Well, then who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the fellow's name?
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first base.
Who?
The guy playing
who
first.
Who is on first?
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
That's it.
That's who?
Yes.
Hello, Olympic Games. What can I do for you, Mr. Double A? You've got a game. How many couples? 18 people? That's a hell of a lot of people. In this. Well, the ideal game is, I mean, 2-3 couples, you know, come over to the house, they get a little smashed, and, you know.
Oh, somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. Somewhere bands are playing, and somewhere hearts are light. Somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out.
This is Casey Stengel. And I would have to say the first time that the New York Yankees win the pennant in 1949, when we played the Boston Red Sox, the last two games of the playing season. And a ball was hit naturally out to right field, and we caught a man going into the home plate, and we ended up as the victors. And I believe I was more excited because of my first World Series that I had been accustomed to get into to see if I couldn't go on and make a record.
Fan yelled that Satch was still jangling his juices. And I asked him if it was true.
Yes, Joe, it's two things I'm doing. I'm jangling my juices and keeping my age, because a lot of people want to find out how old I am.
What's the smallest target you've ever thrown over?
The smallest target I ever thrown over was a top off of a Coca-Cola bottle.
And I think that I'll ask this first gentleman here, who has been watching the ball game, how he's enjoying the game. Sir, how'd you like the first game today?
Well, of course, being a Washington fan, I thought it was great.
Are you originally from Washington, sir?
No, I'm a Californian.
What sort of work do you do, sir?
I work for the government.
Oh, for the government?
Yes,
huh?
Yes, I work for the government.
What sort of work do you do, sir?
Well, I'm the vice president.
Of course, baseball isn't all fun. It often fills our hearts with sympathy for those in pain.
Well, I think Mantle tolerated more pain than any ball player that I know of, or any athlete, I'd say. And he would wrap 9 foot by 6 inch wide Conco bandage gauze on him. We always rubbed him with anointment, what we call a liniment, hot liniment, before he put the bandages on.
And we feel special sympathy for those who'll never play again, like Roy Campanella. Or for those who courageously try a comeback, like Tony Conigliaro.
And I don't think there's anybody in the game that was closer to death than I was in that I got hit. And I just said a couple of prayers just to stay alive. I wasn't ever even thinking about my future in baseball. I was just thinking about keep being alive.
It's the drama of baseball that demands we worship our heroes.
Yes, can we have your autograph?
What's your name?
Jim.
Yours?
John.
John?
And, of course, its drama demands that we despise its villains.
Open your eyes up, you stupid game! You bum up!
It's baseball that can make us happy enough to burst into song.
Say hey!
Say who?
Swing it at the plate, say hey!
Say who?
Say Willie, that giant.
He started baseball's famous streak that's got us all aglow. He's just a man and not a freak. Jolton Joe DiMaggio.
Joe DiMaggio. He wants you
on our side.
Denny McClain, Denny McClain. There's never been any like Denny McClain.
It's baseball that can make us sad enough to burst into tears. Like the day Lou Gehrig said goodbye.
Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
What a great feeling it is to get hungry out at the ballpark along about the sixth inning.
Hey, hot boy! Hey, hot boy! Hot, hot! Hey, it's a hot boy!
And it's baseball that often makes us proud. The only American sport that gets the President of the United States to officially open its season.
Mr. President, have you had an opportunity to do any warming up for this, sir?
Well, we've just been getting ready here today.
He's throwing nothing but strikes.
Oh, nothing but strikes. It's very good.
I feel it important that we get a... not be a nation just of spectators, even though that's what we are today, but also a nation of participants, particularly to make it possible for young men and women to participate actively in physical effort.
Yes, in all the world, there's no other game like our game of baseball. To the old-timer, baseball is that marvelous mixture of stories and men and memories of a bygone era. So for the next few minutes, we're going back in time and hear the actual voices of the grand old men of baseball as they tell it like it was. Listen.
No question about the greatest player is Ty Cobb. A fella could do anything. You'd have Detroit beat one run in the ninth inning. You get two men out and that Cobb invariably would come up. You could bet your life that he'd get his fourth third base before you could get that next man up.
Ty would cut you down. There's no doubt about that. He'd cut you down. If you didn't give him a spot to go into that bag, if you give him a spot, he told many and many, I heard him tell him, but if you don't give me room, I'll cut you out to get in there.
Cobb could have been an awfully popular fella, but boy, everybody despised him. His personality was rotten.
You know, they talked to me about Cobb being the greatest ball player ever lived, but I always say that one of the greatest ball players ever lived. I said, in my book, Honus Wagner is the greatest ball player ever lived, in my book. I've seen him in his prime. He could do everything. Cobb could only play the outfield. Honest could play outfield, infield, or anywhere, and do everything. Wonderful arm, could run, you know, a big bow-legged guy could run like a scared rabbit.
It was fun to play for McGraw. McGraw never got on you for a mechanical error, but any mental error, he was all over you, and he had the most vicious tongue of any man that ever lived, I think.
Finest and the grandest man in the world to work for. He loved his players, the players loved him. He was wonderful. Although the newspaper men, they called him Muggsy, and that was the only thing he despised. Anybody called him, he didn't care who it was, he'd take a pop at him, and he couldn't lick a stamp.
You know, we used to hit a squash. We didn't have a baseball in our day. Sound about like hitting a squash.
They threw every pitch they throw today and more. I used to use licorice and make the ball as black as your hat. Just imagine Ty Cobb hitting the emery ball, the spit ball, the coffee ball. Well, they used to put coffee, chew coffee, and put it in the seams. See? Make that ball skip. Imagine Cobb hitting 367 lifetime for more than 20 years.
Old Grover Cleveland Alexander, boy, he had stuff. Don't think he didn't.
Perhaps Alec was the greatest of them all because of the conditions under which he pitched. He pitched 16 shutouts in 1916, didn't he? In Baker Bowl, where you could spit over the right field fence.
You never relieved Matheson. He always pitched a full game. Greatest pitcher that ever lived, in my opinion.
Vance was the roughest man I ever faced, deadly. You go to him on a Monday, come directly overhand, and this would be going like this, and then he'd be pitching out of diapers and bed sheets in the buildings back of, you know, in Washington, Monday. Between those diapers and bed sheets and the white thing here, you lost it entirely. You never saw it. But he threw balls by me, I never saw it.
I hit again Walter Johnson in an exhibition game, but I'm telling you, that Walter could buzz him by you.
The first time I went up, I thought it was a beehive. I heard three buzzes, and the umpire said, "You're out." Just like three bees flying by. Buzz, 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 yeah.
So I went to Ed DeBarrow, and I said to him, "Ed, why don't you put Babe in the outfield? We need his hitting." And oh, he says, "This is the best left-handed pitcher in the league." He says, "I'd be the laughing stock of the league if I put my best pitcher out there." I argued with him. I said, "When Babe pitches, you got a big crowd out here. Why are they out here? They're out here to see him hit." He says, "I'll put him out there, but you mark my word." He says, "The first slump he gets into, he'll be down on his knees begging me to pitch."
Baseball is that marvelous mixture of stories and men and memories of a bygone era. It's also the thrilling play-by-play memories of this era, the era of broadcast.
Well, folks, it's time for me to be saying, this is Graham McNamee speaking, good afternoon all.
Those years from the early 30s to the late 60s, when radio and later television brought all the excitement of the diamond right into our homes. From among the hundreds of broadcasters that ever called a ball game, we picked one of the very best, Kurt Gowdy. And he's going to take it from here.
The 30s began as if they were jealous of the 20s. "If it's slugging the long ball they want to hear on their radio," said Hack Wilson, "that's what we'll give them." And with that, the stubby fire plug of the Chicago Cubs belted 56 home runs and drove in the all-time high of 190 RBI. And for good measure, Bill Terry batted 401. It was during the 30s that we listened to our first All-Star game and our first night game. And if you listen closely, you'll hear not the first, but the last World Series game those long-suffering Washington Senators ever won.
Joe Cronin of the Senators is up with Heinie Minucci on first.
Minucci on third, Cronin on first, and Schulte at bat.
The Depression of the early 30s produced a new kind of baseball folk hero, the raw-boned scrappers from the dirt farm, like Pepper Martin and a couple of brothers named Dean.
"Well, dears, the pennant race will soon be on again. What do you think of our chances for the pennant next season?"
Well, Daff, I think the St. Louis Cardinals will win the pennant again in 1935, and I'm hoping they do. And if you come through and I do, I think we'd be sure to win. Say, Daff, how's that old soup bone of yours feel this year?
It feels fine, Diaz. I hope that I can win 20, 25 games next year. How's that ham hock of yours feel?
Well, I hope that I can win 25 or 30 more games this year with that baby, and I think that I can squeeze 30 more games out of it this year.
The Gas House Gang. When they weren't running wild in the base paths, they were playing some pretty wild music, as their manager Frankie Frisch explains.
I had the good fortune to manage a terrific ball club. They managed themselves, if you know what I mean. I am possibly the only manager that carried an orchestra. We traveled with more instruments than we did shirts or anything else. And there is the placard as we got off the train. The Guest House Gang plays here today. A tremendous picture of the Mudcat Band. Down in the corner is a little picture of Medwick. Over there is a picture of Mize. I walked in the ballpark, and here is a microphone and 7 seats for my orchestra.
From 1929 through 31, the Yankees' murderer's row couldn't kill off Connie Mack's athletics. Simmons, Cochran, Fox, Dykes, Earnshaw, and Grove. Nor could they knock off Greenberg, Gehringer, Goose Goslin, and the Tigers of 34 and 35. But by 1936, manager Joe McCarthy had blended veterans and rookies to form another dynasty.
A ground ball to Gehrig. He scoops it up. Touches the bag for the third out, and the 1936 World Series is over. The final score, Yankees 13 runs, 17 hits, 2 errors. The Giants 5 runs, 9 hits, 1 error.
There's the stretch. The count is strike 2 and ball 1. There's a mighty smash into right center field. It's a base hit again. DiMaggio goes over, and his speed is to his advantage, and he holds that mighty blow to a single. Picks the ball up on the first hop. He went across after that ball. Boy, how he went across. That DiMaggio is a star in 3 very, very important ways. He can run like the devil. He can throw, and he can bat. And he's just a kid.
There's the pitch. A hard hit fly ball going far out into left field. Reynolds goes near it, and the ball is over the fence for a home run. Over the fence for a home run. Crosetti hitting a home run over the left center field fence, driving in Hoag ahead of him and putting the Yankees out in front by a score of 4-3. The first home run of the series. It's hit by Frankie Crosetti in the first half of the 8th inning. He drives in 2 runs, and the Yankees are out in front by a score of 4-3, as the complexion of the game has been completely changed. First of the 9th, leading off for New York, Tommy Hendrick batting left-handed. Dizzy Dean on the mound for Chicago. First pitch, and it's a hard hit ball for a base hit going into right field. Good for a single. Hendrick lines the single into right field to open the 9th inning for New York. It was hit number 5 off Dizzy Dean. Correction, hit number 6. Hendrick on first base. Nobody is out. DiMaggio up. Score 4-3 New York. DiMaggio batting right-handed. 1 hit and 3 times up. The pitch hitting straight away, a long high fly ball going far out into left field. The ball is over the fence for a home run. A tremendous smash far over the left field fence for a home run by Joe DiMaggio, driving in Hendrick ahead of him and making the score now 6-3. New York over Chicago.
Three pitching performances highlighted the 1930s. King Carl Hubbell struck out in succession 5 of baseball's greatest sluggers in the 1934 All-Star Game. Johnny Vandermeer pitched back-to-back no-hitters in 38, and that same year, a 20-year-old fireballer from the Iowa farms threw this beauty.
And down goes Chet Labs for the 3rd strike. That makes it 18 for Bob Feller, a new major league record.
the 30s closed with an opening. Baseball's Hall of Fame at Cooperstown, New York, held dedication ceremonies in 1939, presided over by Commissioner Kennesaw Mountain Landis.
Ladies and gentlemen, I now declare the National Baseball Museum and the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, the birthplace of baseball, open. May it forever stand as a symbol of clean play and good sportsmanship.
We now pay honor to the members of the Baseball Hall of Fame, great players and great sportsmen of the past and present. Cornelius A. McGillicuddy, Connie Mack,
I feel greatly honored in being here today where our first national game was started by Major Abner Doubleday.
And now, Hannes Wagner, the Flying Dutchman, the greatest shortstop in the game's history.
Ladies and gentlemen, I was born in 1874. And this organization that started was 1876. And when I was just a kid, I said, I hope someday I'll be up there playing in this league. And by chance, I did. Now, Connie Mack, the gentleman that preceded me here at the mic, I remember walking 14 miles just to see him play ball for Pittsburgh.
Now, the next memorial to come before the mic is Trist Speaker, greatest defensive player of all time and a great hitter.
I'm very happy indeed to have been chosen by the sports writers as a member of this great Hall of Fame.
Napoleon Larry Lajoie.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm very glad to be here today and to meet all the old-timers that you, probably a lot of you, have watched playing baseball and some of the greatest men that ever walked on the ball field.
Grover Cleveland Alexander.
I'm proud to be a member of these gentlemen who have been here before me and will follow me up here. And in my dreams, I often think what I could do today with a team like they were, if they could be now what they were then.
Babe Ruth, the Bambino.
You know, to me, this is just like an anniversary myself. Because 25 years ago yesterday, I pitched my first baseball game in Boston for the Boston Red Sox.
This Hall of Fame ceremony marked the end of the 30s. Yet even as these first immortals were being enshrined, hundreds of young ball players were out sliding, out hustling, out hitting each other, so that someday they too might be elected to Cooperstown. These were the players of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. And their stardom was just beginning.
Here we've been listening to Baseball, the First 100 Years. I think I'm going to keep it at that. Go ahead and, it was narrated by James Stewart and Kurt Gowdy. I believe that was in 1976 this came out, judging by what they're saying. Anyway, this is the Grand Hour, and you're listening to 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio. If you like what we're doing here at 91.5 WMFO, consider donating. Go to WMFO.org and click on our donations drive tab to see how you can help us keep it freeform. I brought a few different albums here today. I'll just go ahead and play this, but first we have to FCC obligation.
/111, and I had a stroke. When I woke up, I couldn't speak or walk.
145/92, and then I had a heart attack.
182/100, and I had a heart attack and a cardiac arrest, and then a stroke. Everything changed. It felt like my life was over.
This is what high blood pressure sounds like. You might not feel its symptoms, but the results from a heart attack or stroke are far from invisible or silent.
150/90, and I had a stroke. If I would have followed a treatment plan, I would not be in this situation.
180/110, and I had a stroke.
and I'm 33, so I never see this coming.
If you've come off your treatment plan, get back on it or talk with your doctor to create an exercise, diet, and medication plan that works for you. Go to loweryourhbp.org.
I had to tell. Everything's changed. Head to toe.
Brought to you by the American Heart Association, American Medical Association, and the Ad Council.
Thank you, Ad Council. Okay, for the second half, I'm going to continue my baseball's opening week show here with, I don't know if I've played this. It's been so, the pandemic's kind of COVID the last couple of years. This is Red Jones. He was an umpire, considered one of the funniest baseball umpires. So we'll go ahead and listen to this for the remainder of the show. Again, my name is Arthur, and this is the Grand Hour here at 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org. Thanks for listening.
We're talking to Red Jones, umpire in the American League in the 40s, and Red had a reputation for being one of the most colorful men in the game. And a lot of people, Red, are interested in knowing just exactly why any man in his right mind would want to become an umpire.
Well, Al, I tried to play baseball. I wasn't good enough. I couldn't hit. And when you can't hit, you might as well forget it. I could bang that ball to all corners of the infield, but I couldn't get it up and away into orbit. And I was advised by club owners and teammates, coaches, managers. They said, Red, we love you. We want you with us, but seek some other phase of the game. Take up tickets, sell tickets. But don't come back down here. You don't help us. It was hard to get through to me. I had a burning desire to play ball. And just like the grass, perennially, I would show up, try to make this ball club. And finally, the message got through. One day, the manager tossed me a mitt in an exhibition game, and he said, Jones, go out and relieve Stewart at first base. I grabbed the mitt, started out. He turned to the coach, said, what's the score? The coach said, 10-2, eighth inning, skipper, we're behind. And the manager said, sit down, Red, we're not giving up yet. And one time they told me I'd been traded. I said, for whom? Where am I going? He said, for nobody. It's an even up trade and we think it'll strengthen our ball club. What Branch Rickey calls strength by subtraction. Get that bum down the road and we're a better ball club. And one fella suggested umpiring. He said, Red, take up umpiring. You can go as long as your legs and your eyes hold out. Well, you see what happened to the eyes. The legs are still pretty good, but I had fastball glasses and curveball glasses. I had to change between pitches. And there happened to be a left-hand pitcher on the ball club that met with the same misfortune that I met with. He couldn't throw a curveball. I couldn't hit it. So I figured we had something in common. And he latched onto me and decided he would become an umpire. The only trouble was he had defective vision. He was cross-eyed. I guess you would say he was cockeyed, because I've heard guys on the bench say that old Lefty could watch a tennis match and never move his head. He'd sit right there and watch it. So I didn't have guts enough, Al, to refuse him. If he wanted to go out there and umpire, I had nerve enough to go with him. Now, this goes back a few years. This is 1931. The first depression that I remember was descending upon the country. There was no money. And I'd umpire for sustenance, pea soup and jelly cake, a big orange, anything. And one afternoon, Bruce Dudley, the general manager of the Louisville Club, offered me $5 to umpire balls and strikes. They wouldn't let Lefty go behind the plate. He has the base umpire. So I said, okay, you got a deal. I said, how about Lefty? Can I bring him along? He said, yeah, bring Lefty. I said, five? He said, no, 2.5. We don't have the money. I said, he won't come for 2.5. He's got a lot of pride. He thinks he's worth as much as I am. And I do, too. He said, well, present the proposition, and if he wants to come, we'll use him. If not, we'll put a pitcher over at third, another ball player over at first, and they can call the plays on the bases, and you can work balls and strikes. So I said, all right, let me go back to the boarding house, not the hotel now. Times are tough. I went back to the boarding house and told Lefty about the offer, and he's mad as he can be. He's insulted. And I said, well, come on and go. Somebody might see us and give us a shot in organized ball. Come on, Lefty, don't be too proud. So I prevailed upon him, and he reluctantly accepted. We went out. Everything went splendidly for about five innings until some guy slid into second base that was as safe as if he's in an armored truck. He's standing on the bag, dusting himself off. The baseman touched him with the ball. Lefty said, you're out! And the runner wheeled on him and said, what kind of lousy umpiring is that? He said, the best you'll ever see for 2.5 a game.
Red, you went on and worked for a brewery after a while, didn't you, Red?
Yeah, the only connection that I want to bring out about having worked for a brewery and umpired practically all my life is the fact that I had a hell of a lot more fun hustling the full ones than I had ducking the empties.
Red, one of your most unusual experiences when you worked, after you got out of Major League umpiring, you went over to Jackson Prison and umpired a game. Now, how does a prison game work?
Well, it was on Sunday afternoon, was for the playoff. All the candy, they had a split season, and the winners of the first half were going to play the winners of the second half. And the distributor in Jackson, Michigan, where the Southern Michigan prison is located, was a friend of the warden. And this is the big game. And those fellas are going to bet a little bit. They bet razor blades, cigarettes, cigarette papers, matches, and one thing. And they wanted a man of integrity and honesty. they don't trust everybody, you know. So they wanted me to come up and umpire the final game for all the marbles. And I'm there, ready to call play ball. Each team has completed its fielding practice, its hitting practice, and I'm ready for the first pitch. But the catcher decides that he wants to have a final word with the pitcher. And he goes out to the pitcher's mound to talk. And standing in the batter's box was a little fellow about the size of Phil Rizzuto, a small guy. And he's got a friendly face looking up at me and smiling. And I looked down at him. I said, what they got you in here for, Shorty? He said, for killing a big guy about your size.
Red, one of the most serious men in all of Major League Baseball has to be Ted Williams. I mean, he took the game seriously. Before he became the manager of the Washington Senators, he wrote his memoirs for Sports Illustrated magazine. And he alluded to the fact that the funniest thing that ever happened to him in baseball was an incident with the Chicago White Sox in which you were the plate umpire. He said he couldn't tell the story. Can you tell the story now?
Why did he say he couldn't tell it? You were on television, weren't you? You think we can get by with it?
Let's try, Red. What happened?
Well, here we go. There had been a beanball epidemic over in the National League. Every time the Cubs met the Giants or the Dodgers met the Giants, they would throw at each other, and they were throwing for keeps. When you throw behind the man, that's where you really mean it. So there was a fellow by the name of Joe Haynes pitching for the White Sox, and Williams is at bat with two men on. And Haynes is Joe Cronin's brother-in-law, who managed the Red Sox, or was president of the Red Sox at that time. Ted Lyons was managing the White Sox. And in comes the pitch to Williams. And I don't think he tried to decapitate old Ted, but he singed his eyebrows, you know. Right there. And I didn't say anything, but Williams is out, laying out on the ground about 4 feet from home plate, rocking on his shoulder blade. And he gets up and gets back in the batter's box, and here comes the same type of pitch. Zing! Right under his chin. So I walk out to the mound, and I don't say a word. And Haynes says, I ain't throwing at him. I said, who said you were? But don't do it again. So I walk back, and on the next pitch, Williams hit the ball into back bay, right out of the park. And Ted Lyons walked out to the mound, and he's fiddle-footing around, giving a guy a chance to warm up down in the bullpen. And I walk out. After about 2 minutes, I walk out. I said, are you going to change pitchers? He said, it's all your fault. You disconcerted my pitcher. I said, if I did, he disconcerts mighty easily. I didn't have that bat in my hand. And he says, yeah, I'm changing. I said, well, let's get the man in here and get along with the game. So I went back to umpire, balls and strikes behind the plate, and just as soon as I took my position, pulled the chest protector up on, you know what, in big inflated windbag that they wear in the American League, I am in position, and I hear from the dugout, Meathead! Meathead! And it deteriorates fast. It really gets bad, you know. And I call Lyons out of the dugout. I said, Ted, now that stuff's got to stop. It's the second inning, and here's Ladies' Day to boot, and all that profanity and obscene language can't be. I'm not going to tolerate that. I said, it's your ball club, your responsibility. Now let's stop it. He said, you stop it. You started it. I said, okay, we'll start with you. Get the hell out of here. I thought that would nip it in the bud, you know, and I'd have no trouble. But I went back again, and here comes the voices. And it's tough to look into a dugout and determine who's hollering. And here I can hear it. Ah, you lousy meathead. Yeah. So I said, come on, let's go. The first three there, don't end. Let's go. You're out of the game. And they left. And I went back to umpire again, and here it comes again, the same thing. By that time, Summers has moved over. Bill Summers has moved over towards the dugout, and he said, which three you want now, Red? I said, give me the three in the middle. And they left. And finally, this continues. It goes on for about 20 minutes. And finally, all of them have been chased. I get the rest of them, all of them. It's on the bench. I said, come on, let's go. I ain't gonna have all this stuff going on all afternoon. And the last guy to leave is Wally Moses. And he's a friend of mine. We went to school together. And as he passes by, he said, Red, what are you running me for? He said, you know, you and I are good, good friends. I never said anything to you. I said, I realize that, Wally. I didn't think you said anything, but you just got in bad company. And, you know how the police do when they raid those houses of ill repute in the pool room? The guys that are sitting around have to go with the bad. The good guys go with the bad. Yeah. And the last word I said to him, today I'm raiding. Go on, Wally, get out.
But Reddit didn't stop there. They didn't stop.
No,
even though the bench was clear.
The bench was cleared. I go back. I know now that I'm not going to have any trouble. I go back, get in position, and the voice comes from the dugout. There isn't a soul, there isn't a face in the dugout. And I'm astounded. I'm amazed. I walk over, and the Chicago White Sox wear a long windbreaker right down almost to the ankles, because in the springtime, that wind off of Lake Michigan, and in Boston, it's very cold. And they had one of these long windbreakers hanging on a nail in the corner of the dugout. And I walked into that dugout, and here are 2 feet protruding from one of those big windbreakers. And I grabbed the coat off the nail, and there's Mule Haas all pouched up in the corner. And Summers, Bill Summers said, if you'd have nailed him in the beginning, it wouldn't have been any trouble. I said, well, why the heck didn't you tell me? He said, I was enjoying it too. My partner. And the only guy that got fined out of the 14 was Bing Miller. As he went by, he offered me his glasses. He took, and if someone took a picture, and it appeared in the Chicago paper, and Mr. Harridge fined him $25 for showing up an umpire. But when we got to the hotel, there was a message to call Mr. Harridge immediately. And he asked, why did you chase 14 Chicago White Sox out of the game today, Red? I said, because 13 is unlucky. And he fined me $50 for insubordination. I lost $25 on the deal. Miller got fined $25, I got fined $50.
Red, one of the things I've noticed in a ballpark is that the catcher very seldom turns and wheels on an umpire on a ball or a strike pitch. But I have watched carefully, and you can see the mass bobbing as if they're talking. Is there some kind of an unwritten rule that he can speak as long as he doesn't turn around and confront you directly?
Yes, Al, more of a custom, I guess you would say. It's not a rule, but they're prohibited from doing it. It's just the code of the game, you know, the umpire's secret weapon, because they don't allow the catcher to turn around and yak face on, because they know that he's violently disagreeing with your decision. Then you, instead of one guy, you've got 40,001 or 50,001. Everybody joins in to take the part of the catcher. And they don't turn around, but the air gets blue. They question your eyesight and immediately get into your ancestry, you know. I had one fella insinuate one afternoon that there hadn't been a marriage in my family for 3 generations. He had to go, you know. But usually it's, they remain within the law. And one afternoon we've got a catcher out here. We're in Tiger Stadium. It was Briggs Stadium at that time. A fellow by the name of Robinson. And he was sort of a high-type moron. You know, we all thought that we were a think ahead of him. And Newhouser is pitching, Harold Newhouser, and evidently had a sore arm in the latter part of his career, and they had given him a shot of Novocaine or something, and he's just goosing the ball up to the plate, and it's not holding up. It falls below the line of demarcation, below the knee, about that far, about 3 or 4 inches. And I call a pitch a ball, and old Robbie throws it back and said, "What the hell was wrong with that one?" And I said, "I didn't like it, that's all. There's 40,000 people here, and I'm the only one you have to please. And I don't explain them, I just call them." And the next pitch comes in, I call it a ball. He throws it back to Newhouser, and he said, "Well, we'll never win a day for that kind of umpiring." Said, "We might as well go in and take a shower. We're through." And I don't pay any attention to him. Next pitch comes in, same identical spot, right below the knee. I rule that pitch a ball. He throws it back to Harold. And he said, he's got 3 kids. I'm trying to pay off a mortgage. You're stealing us blind. What the heck do I care about their personal problems? All I want to do is get the ball game over and go down and have a cold one and enjoy myself. So finally they get the side out, and up comes Robbie. He's a leadoff man, good hitter, cleanup man. Second inning he steps in. And the White Sox have got a pretty good left-handed pitcher, blonde boy by the name of Edgar Smith, and he dropped the first one in on old Robbie right where Newhouser was pitching, right below the knee. And I said, "Tarray!" Robbie turned around and said, "Huh? What? He said, "That pitch is a ball." I said, "That's what I've been telling you all afternoon."
Red, you have always said that you didn't mind getting needled as long as they were clever.
That's right.
And one of the men who was a great needler was Paul Richards when he was a catcher. He is now the general manager at Atlanta. And he could come up with some pretty interesting comments, couldn't he?
Had the most vitriolic tongue I've ever encountered on or off the ball field. We had so many arguments, Richards and myself, everyone thought we were married. You couldn't call one to please him. And he must have lain awake at night thinking of new names for the umpires. You know, I never saw a man. And he would lose control of himself. he come up with one of the best I've ever heard. It just knocked me over because I thought I'd heard everything. He was catching for the Tigers one afternoon, and they were battling for the pennant. It was in 1945. They played the Cubs in the World Series, and there was a man on third base, a visiting runner on third base, and a routine fly ball hit to the outfield, and the runner tagged up and tried to score. And the play at the plate is close. Richards made a hell of a play. He had to go up the first base side, get the ball, made a dive back, and he tagged the hind leg. The front leg is across, see? And he split there, laying on the ground, and I make my decision and call the runner safe, and he looks up and sees me with my palms down, and he really goes nuts. He threw the mask down towards third base, the mitt goes towards first, he reaches up and he's taking off his chest protector, and I said, and he's blaspheming. He's really, oh man, the language. And I said, keep stripping, baby, you know you're out of the game. Pull it all off. Come off with the shin guards, everything. He said, oh, you put me out? I said, sure, you're through. He said, well, everything I said goes double, and you are a revolving sob. I said, now, wait a minute. Before you go, I said, I thought I'd heard all, but tell me, what is this revolving sob? He said, any way you turn, you won.
Red, I've been to many sports banquets, and a story has been told several times. They always change the name of the batter who comes up to the plate in the story, but in all honesty, they never change the name of the umpire who made this little speech. He is always Red Jones. And the story has been told by many people, and I know that you were the umpire behind the plate, but the real batter in this instance was a fellow by the name of Chuck Hostetler. Is that right?
That's true. Correct. Happened in Yankee Stadium, 1944 and 1945. I forget the date. But the Tigers were in the thick of the pennant race both years. And Atlee Donnell starts for the Yankees, and Harold Neuhauser starts for the Tigers. Apparently, Neuhauser hadn't warmed up enough, or maybe his arm was troubling him a little bit. But the Yankees jumped on him and got two runs. In the first inning, he settled down and didn't get another run. Detroit hadn't scored. Come the eighth inning for Detroit to come to bat, and the first two hitters up get on base, and it's Neuhauser's turn at bat. And of course, the play calls for a sacrifice. And Harold attempts to bunt, and both attempts roll foul. Now it's a hot, humid day there, too. And Steve O'Neill, the manager, decides that Neuhauser might hit the ball on the ground on the third strike. Third swing, and he puts in Chuck Hostetler, an outfielder, utility man that he had, great big fella, friendly, had a big smile. The opposing teams always referred to him as Melon Puss. He had a big grin, and they were hollering after Hostetler came in, you know, giving him the rib. So Hostetler is announced, it goes over the loudspeaker, and Hostetler batting for Neuhauser. And I turned to him and I said, Charlie, you know, you have to assume the count that Neuhauser had. There are two strikes on you. And he said, tell him to flop him on in here, Red. I was born that way.
But you know, Red, everyone tells that story. Some make the batter in that instant Yogi Berra. But no one ever tells what Hostetler did with the pitch when it was delivered with the two strikes on it.
He doubled and scored both runners. Yeah. They had put a fast man in to run for the catcher who had walked, and both runners scored. And the Tigers eventually won the ball game in around the 14th inning.
That's the first time I've ever heard the end of that story. You know, you're talking about Yankee Stadium, the price of fame and autograph seeking. You tell a story, Red, of Hank Greenberg and Rudy York when they played with the Tigers, being besieged by autograph seekers in New York City one time. And with them was a rather unknown catcher at the time.
Yeah, that's right. They were leaving the stadium, and Bob Swift accompanied them. And as they went out the player's gate, they were surrounded by these youngsters and wanting the autographs of Greenberg and York. Mm-hmm. And They signed and they said, here's a promising young catcher, Bob Swift. He's joined our ball club and he's bound to become a star someday. Don't you want his autograph? They said, we'll wait.
That was Red Jones, Strikes Back. A little baseball this morning for the opening week of baseball. My name is Arthur, and you have been listening to the Grand Hour here on 91.5 FM and or WMFO.org. Surprisingly, that album was on Motown. Playing under me is Duane Eddy. Fuzzy Twist. Yeah, I'm not trust the CD player to play the usual closeout music. So, if you like what we're doing here at 91.5 WMFO, consider donating. Go to WMFO.org and click our donations drive tab to see how you can help us keep it free phone. Till next week, we'll go ahead and play out the rest of Duane Eddy. Thanks for listening.
Russia's top gag writer.
And just hear what one of Hollywood's greatest stars, Miss Katharine Hepburn, has to say about A Night in the Ukraine.
I'm terribly, terribly mad about the Marx Brothers. Really, I am, really. And I just couldn't wait to see their new film. So I went home.
What a cast!